Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we are taking, a really deep dive into a work that didn't just join the modern literary canon. It sort of blew the doors off how we even define a novel. Virginia Woolf's 1927 masterwork, To the Lighthouse.
Absolutely. It's foundational.
Okay, so let's unpack this right away. Woolf, she's the central voice in modernism, right? Key figure in the Bloomsbury group. And her whole thing wasn't just telling us what people did. She wanted to show us how they felt doing it.
Exactly. That was the huge shift, moving the focus away from just, external events, plots, and plunging deep into the inner world, the mind.
Yeah, the messy, fluid landscape of thought and feeling.
She pretty much pioneered the stream of consciousness technique in English novels throughout those neat, straight Victorian storylines.
Right.
And instead tried to capture life as we actually experience it, moment by moment, all the confusion, the connections, the fragments. It's like being submerged in someone else's head.
And what really hits home with this book, I think, is how intimate it feels. It's so personal.
Oh, intensely personal. You can feel it's built on her own memories.
The whole setting based on her childhood summers down in St. Ives in Cornwall.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. and Mrs. Ramsay. They're basically these incredibly complex living portraits of her own parents, Leslie and Julia Stephen.
You really sense her grappling with their legacy, their influence. Her memory almost shapes the story itself.
Yeah, it feels like it's constructed from memory.
Definitely. It's a novel built on deep emotional architecture. Structurally, it doesn't unfold like a typical story. It's more like, like music, a symphony, maybe, in three distinct movements.
That's movements, right.
And it covers a whole decade, but it's all centered on this one family, the Ramsays and their guests at this summer house. Up on the Isle of Skye.
And the plot itself, when you boil it down, sounds almost laughably simple.
Deceptively simple, yeah.
Just a family holiday. And the big action is whether or not they'll take a boat trip to the nearby lighthouse, which they argue about.
And that argument, that little dispute, that's the core tension. It's not about external action, not really. It's all internal, relational. It's the clash between Mrs. Ramsay, who's all nurturing, intuitive hope, promising young James, yes, we'll go tomorrow.
If the weather's fine.
Right. And then Mr. Ramsay, the philosopher, the embodiment of cold, hard logic, just shuts it down. Nope, weather's clearly going to be bad.
That immediate conflict sets up everything. And it introduces the lighthouse itself.
Which starts as just a place, but quickly becomes more.
So much more. It turns into the novel's central, really enigmatic symbol. It is a destination, sure, but it starts representing objective truth, maybe clarity, something solid in all the mental chaos.
An unknowable reality, perhaps, that each character is trying to reach or define in their own terms. It's a brick tower, yes, but it's also this huge abstract ideal.
It really anchors the whole philosophical quest of the book, doesn't it?
It does. The whole novel is sort of asking, how do we as isolated consciousnesses find meaning, find something permanent when time just keeps washing everything away?
Okay, so if the action is secondary, it's all our perception, these characters, they're not just driving a plot forward. They feel more like, like living case studies in consciousness, as some critics say, vessels of consciousness.
That's a great way to put it.
So where do we start? It has to be with the center of gravity.
Absolutely. Mrs. Ramsay, she is, without doubt, the emotional, even the spiritual heart of the novel.
Her presence is immense.
Immense. She has this incredible ability, this gift for creating moments of unity, harmony. Just out of sheer force of personality, the dinner party scene is the classic example.
Oh, yeah.
She takes all these disparate people, insecure, prickly, self-absorbed, and somehow, just by being there, by guiding the conversation, she fuses them, for a moment anyway, into this single, beautiful, shared experience.
But there's a deep struggle underneath that, isn't there?
Right.
She plays that role, the perfect Victorian angel in the house, smoothing everything over for everyone, especially for the men. But inside, you feel the weight. The knowledge that her efforts are fleeting, that the unity she creates is so fragile, and maybe the sense that she's ultimately quite alone in it.
The burden is huge. Her power is real, but it costs her.
And then there's her opposite number, Mr. Ramsay.
Her foil, exactly. The eminent philosopher. Brilliant, demanding, often quite harsh.
Terrifying to his children sometimes.
Yes, but that intellectual certainty, that constant demand for validation.
Yeah.
It comes from such deep insecurity.
Right. That gnawing fear that his work won't last. that he won't reach R in the great sequence of thinkers, that he'll be forgotten. It's like this massive philosophical imposter syndrome.
Perfectly put. And his journey is so crucial because loss forces him to change. He starts as this, you know, bastion of cold, rational thought, almost emotionally barricaded.
Completely.
But losing his wife forces him onto this painful path towards, well, towards connection, mostly unspoken, but it's there. It leads to that final, essential reconciliation with his son, James.
So if Mrs. Ramsey is the heart and Mr. Ramsey is the head, or the obstacle, then Lily Briscoe must be the artistic consciousness observing it all.
Yes, she's our witness. And she represents something new, the modern woman, unmarried, independent, trying to make sense of it all through her art.
Her struggle to finish that painting, the one of Mrs. Ramsey and Jay, it runs through the whole book. It's like the artistic spine of the novel.
It really is. And what she's trying to capture in that painting is the novel's core dilemma.
How do you reconcile these opposing forces? Mrs. Ramsey's intuitive warmth, that fleeting unity, with Mr. Ramsey's harsh, demanding intellect, that logical severity. How do you get that balance onto a canvas?
Exactly. That's her quest. And when she finally does it, when she draws that final line down the center of the painting 10 years later, that's her moment of triumph.
I have had my vision.
That iconic line. It's the proof, maybe, that art can create something lasting out of the chaos and transience of life.
And framing the whole narrative, bookending it almost, is James Ramsey.
Little James. We meet him as a small boy, just consumed by this fierce, almost primal hatred for his father.
The tyrant who said they couldn't go to the lighthouse.
Exactly. He represents that initial thwarted desire. And then, 10 years on...
he's a teenager. Silent, sullen, dragged along on the very boat trip he once desperately wanted.
But that physical journey forces an internal one. Slowly, grudgingly, his view of his father starts to shift. He moves from pure resentment towards, well, a complex kind of understanding, maybe even respect.
Seeing him navigate the boat, seeing his competence.
And when they finally reach the lighthouse, that moment of clarity hits. He doesn't see the tyrant anymore. He sees his father as a lonely, courageous old man. That shift in perception is his arrival. It's the psychological climax for him.
Okay, let's talk about how Wolf manages this passage of time, these shifts. The structure itself is brilliant. Part one, the window. It feels so immediate, almost claustrophobic.
It is. Part I is just a single day. But Wolf stretches it, packs it with thought and feeling. It's dense, fluid. You're constantly dipping in and out of different minds.
And the high point, as you said, is the dinner party. Mrs. Ramsey orchestrating this fragile moment of connection.
That brief, transcendent unity, it feels perfect, but, you know, you just know. It can't hold.
And Wolf makes sure we know. Part two, time passes. This section is just devastating and so radical.
Utterly radical. It's barely 20 pages, but it covers 10 years.
10 years of loss and decay.
And the perspective shifts completely. It's not human consciousness anymore. It's like the house itself is watching. Time becomes this impersonal, destructive force, just washing over everything, the wind and the rain getting in.
And the really shocking thing is how she delivers the major blows. Mrs. Ramsey's death. Prue dying in childbirth, Andrew killed in the war, just dropped in almost clinically in these bracketed sentences.
Like footnotes to the main narrative of decay, it's brutal. It underscores the indifference of time, of fate.
Which makes the return to human consciousness in part three, The Lighthouse, even more poignant. This takes place 10 years later, again on a single morning.
And the narrative splits here into two parallel tracks, both moving towards a resolution.
Track one, the boat trip.
Right. Mr. Ramsey, James, and Cam finally making the physical journey to the lighthouse. The atmosphere in that boat is thick with unspoken history, with tension.
Decades of it.
But as they get closer, James starts to see his father differently. That silent recognition of his father's skill, his vulnerability, it leads to that moment of connection when Mr. Ramsey just says, quietly, about James's steering, well done.
It's such a small moment. But it bridges this enormous emotional gap.
A huge gap. Meanwhile, back on the shore, you have track two, Lily Briscoe.
Still standing on the lawn, wrestling with that painting, wrestling with memory, with loss, trying to finish what she started 10 years ago. Her struggle is like the emotional journey for everyone left behind.
And Wolf's genius is synchronizing these two threads. Lily has her breakthrough, her final clarifying insight. I have had my vision. She draws the line.
At the exact moment the boat reaches the lighthouse.
Yes. The physical journey completes just as the artistic, emotional journey finds its resolution. It creates this fragile, hard-won sense of, well, not closure exactly, but completion, balance.
Okay, let's pull back and look at the big themes Wolf is weaving through all this. The idea of art as a form of permanence seems absolutely central. Through Lily, mostly.
It really feels like the novel's main answer to the problem of time and loss. Lily's decade-long struggle demonstrates that art is how we fight back against transience. It's maybe the only way to capture and hold on to those perfect, fleeting moments Mrs. Ramsey created in life.
That final brushstroke makes something permanent.
It preserves what time would otherwise erase. Then there's the whole treatment of time and memory.
Which is revolutionary. You have chronological time. That destructive force in part two, set against subjective psychological time, those intensely lived moments in part one.
And memory becomes this active force. It's not just passive recall. It's how the characters reclaim the past, how they keep Mrs. Ramsey's influence alive. It's how meaning persists.
And underneath it all, Wolf keeps asking, what is reality?
Yeah, that fundamental question. Is it the hard objective facts Mr. Ramsey clings to, or is it the subjective felt experience, the intuition that Mrs. Ramsey embodies?
Wolf seems to suggest it's neither, or rather, it's both. Reality isn't one thing. It's this composite, this messy blend of different, often conflicting viewpoints.
And maybe Lily's painting in the end is the closest we get to seeing that composite reality represented, that balance she achieves.
And we can't talk about To the Lighthouse without mentioning the techniques. We've talked about stream of consciousness, that deep dive into characters' minds.
Prioritizing the internal experience over external action.
And the powerful symbolism. We've touched on The Lighthouse shifting from a goal to this symbol of objective truth or stability.
And the window. It keeps appearing, acting as this frame, separating the inner world of the self from the outer world of reality.
And of course, Lily's painting. It becomes the symbol of the struggle itself, the struggle to find order, meaning, balance in the sheer messiness of life.
Her final success, that moment of vision, really affirms the power of the artist to create meaning. It's crystallized right there in that final line. It was done. It was finished. Yes, she thought, laying down her brush in extreme fatigue, I have had my vision.
It's just a stunning achievement as a novel. It really did change what fiction could do.
Absolutely. It proved that a story's real power could lie in perception, in feeling, rather than just in plot. And it affirms, I think, that love and memory can, in some way, endure beyond death.
So here's a final thought for you, the listener. The novel revolves so much around Mrs. Ramsey's incredible gift for creating these fleeting moments of social unity, the perfect dinner party, the evening harmony. But those moments, by their nature, fade.
They can't last.
So, is Lily Briscoe's final artistic victory, that single permanent line on her canvas achieved in solitude, is that the necessary, maybe lonelier, but ultimately more enduring path to finding some kind of lasting truth? Something to think about. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.